I felt like I was in jail today.
Save it for the podcast. Save it for the podcast. All right, so tell that story, Clint. So what have you been doing this afternoon?
Well, hey, everybody. Yeah, I went to jail today. Oh, yeah. Juvenile detention center. So I'm taking some of the creative
writing. You're no juvenile.
No, I know. Just in my heart. I'm taking a writing and community class to the juvenile detention center, which is not called a detention center. I'm so sorry. It's called the Rome Youth Development Center. Just to be like progressive, I think, mm-hmm. makes sense. Although most people call it the Bob because it's named after Bob Richards, so you can just call it the Bob. So I took the kids to the Bob today. The kids being college students,
but
talk creative writing.
And I also hear that you were held up. That.
Well, I mean, there's so many locks and doors, and like it's like such a circuitous route to go through the complex to get to the library where we taught classes, and then to get out of that, blah blah blah. Gotcha. We had to make sure all the pencils were counted. You know, one time I was there and they were about to do a strip search of everyone because they couldn't find a pencil. Some joker had it, but he gave it up, so it was good. Yeah.
Can any of y'all beat that for what you've been doing this afternoon?
I felt like I was in jail today.
All right.
I got nothing.
All right. Welcome, everyone, to Church Potluck, where we are serving up a smorgasbord of Christian curiosity. I'm your host, Dale McConkey, sociology professor and United Methodist pastor. And you know, there are two keys to a good church potluck: plenty of variety and engaging conversation. And this is exactly what we are trying to do here on Church Potluck. We're sitting down with friends and we're sharing our ideas on a variety of topics from a variety of academic disciplines and a variety of Christian traditions. So let's set the table today. What are we going to be talking about?
Everybody's worried about the atomic bomb, but nobody's worried about the day my Lord will come, when he'll hit great God Almighty like an atom bomb when he comes.
It's the Oppenheimer episode, and I might add the long-awaited Oppenheimer episode. J. Robert Oppenheimer, father of the atomic bomb. More recently, the topic of a fantastic movie. So what about the atomic bomb and Christian faith? Why was the first atomic bomb called Trinity? Was creating and dropping the atomic bomb a morally sound choice? And what does it mean for us humans to be living in the nuclear age? What should Christians think about war in general and nuclear war in particular? Let's chew on these and many other questions. You might be asking yourselves, Dale, who are the Church Potluck guests that you have assembled to chat today? And we have a star-studded group of guests here to talk to us. First of all, we have Dr. Todd Timberlake. Todd, you are no stranger to Church Potluck, and we are very glad to have you here again. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
I think this is my third time on the podcast. I am a physics and astronomy professor at Berry College, and I guess I'm here because Oppenheimer was actually a physicist, so I'm representing the physics contingent.
Yes, you are. In fact, we are having this podcast at the absolutely perfect time, and I say that with huge sarcasm, because it is not in too many theaters at the moment. And you can't stream it till December, so it's the wrong time to be having the Oppenheimer. But it is the perfect time because you were not around earlier or later in the late summer to do this, and everybody said we must have Todd Timberlake.
And I hadn't seen the film either. I actually just saw it this past weekend. The timing works great for me.
I will say, for anyone who wants their Oppenheimer fix, Dale, you're it, right, until December.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
I wonder how many people are out there with an Oppenheimer. Is it Oppenheimer or Oppenheimer?
That's a good question. I've always heard it Oppenheimer, but
we'll just go with whatever comes out of our mouth.
I think they refer to him as Oppie, rather than Opie.
Yeah. I just don't feel that close. To
Opie
him.
Is somebody totally different.
I like it. So.
Yeah. All right, Todd. Again, thank you very much. And our next guest is a first timer. We have Dr. Kirsten Taylor. Dr. Taylor, tell us about yourself.
I am a professor of political science and international affairs at Berry College.
Which makes perfect sense for what we're talking about today.
It does. And I also teach an honors class on the atomic era.
Awesome. Ooh. We are very glad to have you both as a first timer and as a guest for this particular episode. And of course, you get a second applause for being first timers. Thank you. And we might give this guy a second applause too. But we have Dr. Clint Peters.
Hello. Good to see you guys. I'm a professor of creative writing, particularly creative nonfiction. Also, film lover. I read a bunch of essays about movies. I have a burgeoning obsessive film collection. I think this is my third time on the podcast. I did one with Todd, and then we did horror. Right? Yeah. I'm on here just to
I'm glad they're so memorable for you.
They were very memorable. I love them. No, it's my memory. It's shot. But yeah, I'm going to just talk about the film and the production, stuff like that.
Fantastic. Let's go ahead. And I've been in the game show mood lately. Let's do another game show. All right. Today's game show, Oppenheimer or Stoppenheimer?
Of course. Already Stoppenheimer.
That's right. Yes.
Too late.
All right. The title of the game show, Oppenheimer or Stoppenheimer? Stoppenheimer. All right. But here we go. So just some questions for you, and you tell us whether you are pro or against with these two titles here. The movie Oppenheimer was very good. Oppenheimer or Stoppenheimer, Dr. Todd Timberlake?
Oppenheimer, all the way.
All the way? Okay.
Oh, yeah, like major Opie Oppenheimer.
Yeah, yeah. So like an Academy Award winner?
Can't imagine.
Yeah, I hope so. Yeah.
That was a very easy one. Good job, everybody. They're going to get a little more difficult as we go along here, though. We should think of J. Robert Oppenheimer as a hero. Oppenheimer or Stoppenheimer? Hmm. You're all thinking for this. Someone just jump in. How about that?
I don't like either of those.
Yeah. I don't,
you just remember the discomfort you're feeling right now when your students are having to take multiple choice.
I would say he's more closely aligned to an anti-hero in like modern contemporary understandings of the term anti-hero. Like someone whose actions we're following, whose goals are understandable, but whose actions also precipitate disasters and other things, unintended consequences, right? And is almost a tragic figure. Yeah.
So y'all are nodding your head in agreement with that. So does that mean I'm not going to be able to force you into this binary here?
Nope.
Up a Stoppenheimer or something.
Ooh.
Like Dale.
You're going to.
Dale, just call me baby because you're not putting me in that corner.
All right. There you go. Well done, baby. All right. Third question. Given the context of World War II, building the bomb was a good thing to do. Oppenheimer or Stoppenheimer?
That's another corner that I don't want to go into.
Yeah.
I have no expertise on which to judge that. So.
Can you define good?
This was for you to decide, and then we were going to discuss the nuance.
So what I will say is I think it's an understandable choice at the time. I understand the people who made the decision to both build it and use it. I understand that choice.
Yeah.
In hindsight, knowing more information than maybe they knew at the time, was that the right choice? I don't want to answer.
Well, how about knowing that the Nazis were also working on this technology?
But they actually weren't very they had some major stumbling blocks.
And they found out about that, it seems.
But that was late in the process that we found out that the Nazis actually were not doing a very good job of developing the bomb. Until that point, it made a lot of sense.
Was Japan also working on it?
Not that I know of.
Okay. Yeah. One thing I'll say is I definitely agree with Todd. I can understand Hiroshima. I definitely second guess Nagasaki. Did they need to drop it twice?
You depends on your goal.
I know.
You have jumped ahead because I try to be precise in saying building the bomb was a good thing to do. The next one, given the context of World War II, using the bomb was a good, I'll even soften it, was an understandable thing to do. Oppenheimer or Stoppenheimer?
With what we knew today, Stoppenheimer.
Hindsight, you'd say Stoppenheimer.
I would.
All right, we'll get more into that for sure. Any others?
I would say Nagasaki, Stoppenheimer. I don't know about Hiroshima enough.
Yeah, I mean, the film touches on the issue of the original goal was to beat the Nazis to making the bomb. And by the time we used the bomb, the Nazis had already surrendered. So, yeah, it's questionable. On the other hand, the invasion of Japan, how many lives would that have cost?
Mm-hmm. That seems to be the debate that people provide.
And I don't know enough about that, too.
I think there's a lot of other reasons to think that Japan might have surrendered anyway, given the chance.
Right. And the film touches on that, I know, but very briefly, but. Yeah, I will defer to Kirsten's knowledge and say Stoppenheimer.
Mm-hmm.
But,
all right.
Yeah.
We all are quite wishy-washy, but I'm still gonna give you the game show correct sound, and thank you for playing Oppenheimer or Stoppenheimer.
I love games.
Even Alex Trebek doesn't give questions that hard.
It's only going to get easier the rest of the day, right? We are talking about a difficult subject, but let's start off with a fairly easy question. Ty, we're going to toss it over to you. Just watching the movie, and by the way, folks, we're going to just not worry about spoilers or anything because they develop the bomb and they do use it.
Spoilers.
As a physicist, watching this movie, how well do they get? The closer you are to something, you see the mistakes and you see the flaws. Right. But in terms of physicists doing their work together, theoretical and applied, what did you think about the way a physicist's job was portrayed?
I mean, it's interesting because you don't really see them doing much physics, right?
You see all the numbers on the board. Right. Not numbers, sorry, letters, all the letters right. And all the symbols.
It's all symbols. And I will want to watch the film again, in part to study the blackboards a little more closely and see if they're the right things. But I mean, I feel like the portrayal of the physicist was accurate. But mostly what you're seeing is the kind of administrative side of all of that and the negotiations and power struggles.
Well, as an administrator, being chair of your department, how well was it portrayed?
Yeah, well, it's exactly like the way my department functions. No, I mean, I think one of the things I found really interesting was the scenes of the visions in Oppenheimer's head as he's thinking about quantum mechanics and the sound effects that went along with that. And I thought... I wouldn't claim that's an accurate way of portraying what it's like to think about quantum mechanics, but I think it caught some essence of that.
Try to capture visually what's going on in the mind. And so
I think it wouldn't have played as well had they actually just worked through all the mathematics on screen.
Right.
So that was a good choice.
Or just saw Oppenheimer just sitting there staring to space thinking that probably needs a little bit of visual activity there.
Yeah. And one of the things that I, as I understand it, is true about Oppenheimer, the physicist, is that he was more intuitive and less a rigorous mathematician than some physicists. And so that sort of visualization, as opposed to just watching him like write a bunch of things on paper, that may really capture some of how he thought. So yeah, I thought that was very well done. I don't have complaint. There was one statement where they said something about Einstein's special relativity leading to quantum mechanics that I was like, not really.
Yeah.
But other than that, I was pretty happy with the way the physics was portrayed.
I wanted to read a quote to you guys. This is from the editor of the film, Jennifer. I guess it's her last name is pronounced Lame instead of Lame. Jennifer Lame. She wrote that when she decided to work on it, she got excited, quote, "I got excited by how can cinema help you understand something not intellectually, right, but emotionally, right? And it's it's impossible to visualize that in other ways." And I do have a quick question for you guys. Who do you think Nolan talked to first about this movie? You guys want to take a stab at that? Of all the people involved in the film, the answer is... Andrew Jackson, yes, the president of the United States. No, just kidding. He is the visual effects supervisor who has that unfortunate name because Nolan wanted to talk to him about how could we make these like very intellectual things emotional for viewers.
Right.
Let's face it, like I would admit this, like I'm not going to be able to intellectually analyze the things going on, but I want to feel the headspace of what Oppenheimer and his fellows are like going through. What does that feel like?
Interesting.
So early on, the special effects supervisor would make these footages of like metallurgy, like metals like dripping into water and like waveform plasma stuff.
Uh-huh.
And the second person he talked to was his composer. He would show the composer these images and the composer would start thinking about the music. Because I think this movie is such a sonic experience, which is one of the reasons I'm a little... do you guys feel this? I feel like there's going to be this anti-Oppenheimer wave coming once it hits streaming because people are going to watch it on their phones and be like, oh, this is boring.
How did y'all see it?
I saw it in the theater.
I saw 70mm.
Oh, I wish I could have, but no.
I was looking for an IMAX theater and couldn't find it, so I just saw it on a regular theater in Ackworth. However, I was the only person in the theater, save one other person. And
It was a small crowd.
It was a small crowd, and just the sound was... It was intentionally loud in spots, obviously, but it was very loud for one person in an empty theater. Let's get into the morality of the issues. And Todd, one of the things that you said is there certain knowledge that should be forbidden? And I'm just thinking, what's going through your mind when you ask that kind of a question? It seems like that this is a very difficult thing to achieve, the idea of forbidding certain knowledge.
So from a physicist perspective, we tend to view the universe as something that is out there to be discovered, right? And there are no limits to what we might discover. There is no knowledge that's forbidden. And I think physicists tend to think that more knowledge is always better because, I mean, that's what we're there for, is to try and accumulate that knowledge. But you could certainly argue that there is some knowledge that can certainly be used in dangerous and harmful ways. And it does raise the question of would we actually be better off not knowing those things, not ever knowing those things, somehow being forbidden from knowing those things.
This actually gets down to the root, no pun intended, of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, right?
That, it brings that story to mind, right? That are we casting ourselves out of the garden by meddling mm-hmm. with this knowledge that really we ought not to meddle with? And I will freely admit that I don't lean that way. I tend to be on the side of, like, it's better to know than to not know. But it does raise that question of, I guess in my mind, are we capable of dealing with the knowledge that we find? And that's really, how, I guess, how I would spin it, is that the knowledge in itself is neither good nor bad. But are we mature enough? Are we wise enough to use that knowledge in an appropriate way, or are we going to kill ourselves with it?
This is a theme that has come up in several of our episodes, whether we're talking about the internet or artificial mm-hmm, intelligence mm-hmm. and now nuclear war.
Oh, yeah. AI is like very much the same thing, yeah. I think.
That we have these powerful tools. That's why I think of these as tools that can be used for tremendous good, but also this knowledge can be used for tremendous evil. And so your question goes to, can we restrain ourselves from the evil side
right.
of these tools in order to use them for the good? And your answer is?
I hope that the answer is yes. I'm optimistic.
So as a physicist, you're saying you have faith in the answer
well,
is yes?
I have, when I say faith in humanity, there are certainly things that rock that faith on a regular basis. But yeah, I guess I hope that we are wise enough to not utterly destroy ourselves. But that doesn't mean there's not going to be a lot of pain and suffering along the way. So,
Kirsten, do you have an input on that?
Oy, I want to also have that faith in humanity. I think we know the costs of using these weapons that we have. But I think sometimes, even as much as we may want some things, we are prone to behaviors that kind of lead to the worst outcomes. Mm-hmm. So I think it's not just a matter of what we want, really, is what I'm getting at. That it's also a matter of our perceptions, our likelihood of misinterpreting things. And we've got these weapons, and not only do we have them, but we've got them on the ready to use. And so I'm not maybe so optimistic.
I'm worried because I think that no matter how many well-intentioned good people are out there, that there are is always someone trying to figure out a way to game the system or to get an advantage. Mm-hmm. And whether you're talking about new software technology or this artificial intelligence that we're talking about, but especially when you get up to the level of nuclear weapons, that it just takes just a handful of people, or not even a handful of people, to want it for ill purposes
right.
to really create literally destruction.
And I mean, we have a lot of controls for these things, but also different countries have different levels of controls, too. So, mm-hmm. I mean, that is a real concern, I think.
Very good. Todd, what else do we need to know from a physicist's perspective on these issues?
Oh, gosh. I have to confess that nuclear physics is not my area of expertise. So, on the technical side, I know the theory of how you build a nuclear weapon. And thankfully, it turns out that knowing that theory is not really the hard part of building a new, it's actually getting your hands on the materials that you need to do it is the really hard part. And I do like how they touched on that issue in the film of actually the development of the weapons grade uranium and plutonium that you don't see happening at Los Alamos, right? But they have the glass bowls with that it puts the marbles in. To represent.
Well, going back to Clint's point, coming up with a visual way to portray what
right.
was happening.
Yeah. And they don't have to take you to Oak Ridge to look at the gaseous diffusion plant. But that, in some sense, that was really the hard part of building the weapon, right? There was the difficult theory part of just understanding was it even possible to do this? But then once you realize that, okay, yeah, the physics checks out and you actually can do that, you can produce this runaway chain reaction of nuclear fission, then the hard part is actually stuff that happened elsewhere. But yeah, beyond that, I don't really know a lot of the details of the nuclear physics. So I don't know that I have any special wisdom.
Do you have any particular insight, any of you, into Oppenheimer himself? Was he really that level of struggling that the movie portrayed over these issues? I guess later on, he definitely would.
Yeah. I mean, he's an interesting figure from what I know, and I don't know a lot, but he had a very successful career before he got involved in the Manhattan Project and was primarily doing stellar astrophysics.
Something you could speak to.
A little bit, but yeah. But he was involved in kind of understanding what happens when you have stars that are like really massive and the formation of things like neutron stars and black holes. He contributed a lot to our understanding of that. And those are things that are very theoretical. I mean, neutron stars and black holes, we think are real things out there in the universe, but they're not things that impinge on our lives in any practical way.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think in some sense, this shift to working on an atomic weapon was a radically different type of work for mm-hmm. him. And it involved a set of moral choices. You don't really have to worry much about morality when you're doing like the theory of stellar structure. You do when you're developing an atomic bomb. And so, yeah, I mean, I think I have the sense that his science led him in a certain direction that ended up sort of the human side of it was very different from anything he'd ever experienced before. And I think in a lot of ways, he probably was not ready for that. Not surprising. I don't know that who would have been. But yeah, he does become this tragic figure, as we were saying before, that I think was trying to do the right things, but was caught up in dealing with questions that he wasn't prepared for. Because it ceased to be questions about physics at some point and became questions about behavior and choices that we as human beings make. And physicists are not, they are perhaps less expert at those than the ordinary everyday citizen.
Which is
certainly not more expert.
Perfect segue into maybe some other folks, such as experts in international relations, might be.
Yeah.
And Kirsten, I want to hear a little bit about this whole project from your perspective in international relations, but also you and I are both United Methodist members, and you've got some context in terms of the Christian position on warfare that you're going to talk about as well. Just from the international relations perspective, the idea of nuclear weapons, what are the issues? What are some of the major themes that you address with your class? Maybe is a good place to start that are relevant to what we're talking about here.
Yeah, I mean, we do address a lot of the things, not specifically about Oppenheimer, but about what the morality behind the bomb, about why we pursued it in the first place, should it have been dropped, and in the class I teach, I mean, we do deal with it a little bit historically, and we eventually get into the IR side of things. But I would say
IR being international relations.
Yes. I mean, this is a huge area of research in international relations. So there's so much we could talk about. In terms of some of the questions we have already opened up on the floor here today, I mean, there is the question of should we have pursued the bomb? And I think we did touch upon the fact that at the point in time when the U.S. was starting up the Manhattan Project, aggressively working toward the bomb, we really did think that Germany was also working in the same direction. Mm-hmm. And so from a national security perspective, it did make sense, right? Mm-hmm. If our adversary is building potentially this big, massive weapon, and not just an adversary, but someone we're actively at war with, then of course we want such a weapon too, so that we either can preempt their use or otherwise dissuade them from using it. So there is that issue, right? But then there's the question about, like as Todd mentioned, once the war had ended with Germany, why did we need to use the bomb? And so there's a lot to think about here. And it's not just a question of whether or not Japan was going to surrender. I mean, the conventional wisdom is we needed to use the bomb because it would save lives on the American side and maybe even also on the Japanese side. It would prevent us from having to engage in another deadly invasion.
The thinking here was that Japan was so committed to not surrendering that they would just, this would be a war of attrition and lives would be lost over many months, maybe even more years, and the bomb would put a very rapid end to things.
Right. And so that has been for decades, right, the conventional wisdom. But I think there's a lot of research to suggest that the war probably wasn't going to drag on that long. Mm-hmm. And the Soviets had just entered the war we were already bombing all of their other cities conventionally. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, Hiroshima was picked because it was set aside actually for this purpose to be a demonstration for the bomb. But like almost every other city had already been bombed conventionally. There was no place left to bomb.
I love the scene in the film where it's the Secretary of War is don't bomb Kyoto because I did my honeymoon there. And that's true.
It is.
Right?
Yeah.
It is a beautiful city.
It is.
I'm glad they didn't.
And so there are so many moral issues to think about. So the question then is, okay, so if we didn't need to use the bomb to end the war, why did we use it? Mm-hmm. Right. And so there's a lot of reason to believe it was geopolitics, that
we are allies with Russia, but not friends with Russia. And so using the bomb would send a message for the post-war
era. More of a demonstration for other countries rather than for
Japan.
Yeah. And the movie definitely alludes to this multiple times.
Yes.
It does. Definitely. And I think it's important to recognize that was not just really background consideration, but it probably was a significant factor contributing to that decision.
What would you say to the folks who would say, this is so much second-guessing 70 years after the fact, that when you're in the throes of war, do we really have good enough insight into what was happening then and there that we can second-guess the decisions that were made then? What would you say to that?
I think that's a good question, but I think we can second-guess. I think that there is logically some reason to doubt the likelihood that the war was just going to grind on and on. I think the U.S. had, prior to dropping the bomb, as I understand it, had a very firm offer out there to Japan that, or really a demand that they surrender unconditionally. That could have been loosened up and Japan could have been given more room to maybe to surrender in a way that was more amenable to them, or they would be more amenable to. And there's just so many different paths that could have been taken, I guess it's the best answer I have, that there's so many paths that could have been taken that there's no reason to think that we only had that one option to end the war. Thank you. Cannot know for sure, of course, how they would have turned out had we taken those other paths.
I'd like to ask a question about, because you mentioned the conventional bombing of other cities. And one thing that I've wondered about is, obviously, the dropping of the atomic bomb, tremendous destruction, tremendous loss of life. Was it really, in that sense, that much worse than some of the conventional bombing?
Yeah, like the Tokyo firebombing was crazy.
Or like Dresden in Germany. Yeah. I mean, there are other examples where I think you could say, well, that was just as bad. So then what is it about the use of the atomic bomb that somehow sets that apart from all these really awful things that had already been done by that point in the war?
Yeah, I mean, those other bombings that you mentioned, Tokyo, Dresden, they killed, I think, far more people, but over months or years, whereas the atomic bomb was like 70,000 people in the initial blast in Hiroshima, and then over the course of months, 35 or something.
I thought it was interesting that the movie also makes it clear that the hydrogen bomb would have been, was it 10 or 100 times more destructive than those bombs?
More than that, yeah. So, I mean, I think the difference in the atomic bomb is that it is truly a weapon of mass destruction, that it does, a single bomb can actually cause so much death and destruction.
So getting into the sort of the church part of church potluck now, you said there were many paths that could have been taken. What were some of the more Christian options, or was there a Christian option? How should Christians look at warfare and international relations? What are some of the options and perspectives out there?
I don't know that there's a Christian option to ending World War II necessarily.
Well, I meant war in general because, I don't think that there was a unified voice out there among Christendom saying, here's how we end it.
Yeah.
But I guess let me put it this way. In my Christian ethics class, when I was training to be a minister, the professor basically said, there are two options within Christianity. There's just war and there's pacifism, and there's really not a whole lot, right? Maybe there was holy war back in the day, but that is not an option among Christians today. It's either just war theory or this is obviously not an act of pacifism. What was or wasn't done according to just war, or maybe I don't mean to put you on the spot.
No, you're not. I mean, just war theory fundamentally says that there are limits to when it is right or moral to initiate a war. There are also limits to how war should be fought. And so to be just, wars really need to be fought solely for defensive purposes. They should be limited in scope so that you have limited objectives and you use the weapons that are appropriate for accomplishing those limited objectives and no more. So a limited objective might be gaining territory or gaining control of a population. War should not be unlimited without objective. You just pummel the adversary for the sake of killing them.
And it sounds like another phrase from your initial, nor should they be preemptive,
That gets really tricky.
It gets really muddy in terms of what is preemptive and what isn't. Okay.
Yeah, because there are all sorts of theories that you can use preemption defensively by some accounts. Anyway, and so nuclear weapons, by their very definition, are tools of unlimited war. Right? They do not discriminate between soldiers and civilians or combatants and non-combatants. Their destruction is massive. There's no there's no way to use at least the nuclear weapons we currently have in our arsenal in a limited way. I think tactical nuclear weapons maybe raise different questions, but that's not what Oppenheimer was building.
So you would suggest that from just war theory perspective, nuclear weapons off the table then?
Because, yes.
Because they breach the protocol of just war theory.
But is it a matter of degree? Because conventional large explosives also don't discriminate between combatants and non-combatants. But obviously the nuclear weapons are doing that on a much, much larger scale. And like you say, all at once rather than a cumulative effect over time.
Yeah. I mean, we have other weapons that we use regularly that also do not discriminate. Cluster munitions mm-hmm. that are being used by Ukraine right now from the U.S. We have all sorts of conventional weapons that do cross the line. If you're using a just war justification, mm-hmm. right?
I'm trying to make clear, I'm not sure that's U.S. policy.
It is just not. War. It is just not.
Right. This is a Christian theological position of when war would be appropriate.
But even
and many Christians disagree with that, just war theory, and say, no, pacifism is the one and only alternative that we can have.
But even just going back to something that Todd had said, there's also the question you ask about degrees, right? So what if your country is about to be defeated in such a way that its very survival is at stake, right? Not mm-hmm, just mm-hmm. the government might fall, it might be defeated, but your people may, a large number of people may be killed, large portions of territory destroyed, right? That's unlimited war. If you are under threat of unlimited war, like a nuclear attack, then does it become justified through just war theory to use a nuclear bomb?
No gray areas. We want black and white. Just give us the answer here.
So my standard line in all of my classes to all my students is the world is not black and white. Mm-hmm. It is gray.
It is so gray. So.
You guys probably know more about this, but there's that scene at the near the end of the film where he goes and meets Truman, right? Played awesomely by Gary Oldman in his Winston Churchill makeup again. And he calls Oppenheimer behind closed doors a crybaby. And I read that was real. He did do that.
I believe so.
And really did want, he's getting Oppenheimer to come here, not to like bond with him and be like, oh my God, we had to do this. But basically to be like, okay, this is great. What's next? He seemed very interested and very keen on promoting nuclear warfare and didn't seem, at least in the film's portrayal, to be very bent out of shape about using the atom bomb. And he says this thing to Oppenheimer. He's like, you didn't push the button. I did that. He wants ownership of that, which I think is evidence to this wasn't just to stop the war that you were mentioning earlier.
I think that's partly it.
Yeah.
I think also we forget so many decades away from the event that even American leaders, American society for sure, but even leaders were quite racist at the time.
Yeah.
And so there was really no sympathy for the people that had been killed.
What's that book, War Without Mercy? Is it John Dower? Okay. Yeah, it's about the racist rhetoric in World War II. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Gotcha.
So what would you say to the folks that would look at what has happened over the past 70 years since World War II that we built up all this arsenal of nuclear weapons. Russia built up a massive arsenal. We now have all other countries that are nuclear states. And we have this mutually assured destruction out there. And we haven't dropped any more nuclear bombs. That it seems to be working. What would you say to this?
So I would say, so as soon as we realized how massively destructive nuclear weapons were, suddenly we kind of, policy leaders decided they're not for use anymore, except to prevent others from attacking us, namely the Soviet Union. Nuclear weapons today pretty much exist for deterrence, mm-hmm. to deter other nuclear powers from attacking us. And we have put a lot of trust and even indeed faith in deterrence. There are a lot of people who argued at the end of the Cold War, deterrence worked. We didn't fire a single nuclear bomb at each other. Deterrence worked. But the problem is it's really hard to prove that it didn't work, right? You can demonstrate when it does work, which fortunately we've not had to observe yet after World War II. But you can't prove that the existence of nuclear weapons prevented nuclear war.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that over the decades, we've come to put a lot of faith in that theory and policy.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I think that a lot of people just assume that because we have great big nuclear weapons and now many thermonuclear weapons that are, in fact, so much more powerful than the bomb that was dropped over Hiroshima. That was just a baby bomb in comparison to some of what we have today.
Which is frightening.
It is very frightening, yeah.
And as I understand it, there are times we came pretty close.
We did, yeah.
That argues against the deterrence idea.
And that goes back to a point I was making at the very start, which is as much as we might not want war, mistakes happen.
Yeah.
But there's three layers, right? So mistakes happen. And so even if you're completely well-intentioned, we could have some problems, right? It also assumes that we're rational actors, that we are acting in our own self-interest, and we're not always rational actors in the way. Right. And also assumes some level of innate goodness. And I think I like the phrase that original sin is the only, or the doctrine of sin, not original sin necessarily, but the doctrine of sin is the only theological doctrine that's been proven over thousands and thousands of human history, that we often act in very poor ways.
And I mean, even going back to the rational actor assumption, you know, that assume, I mean, deterrence is built upon the assumption that we are, our leaders are all rational. They are not going to engage in the amount of harm that a nuclear weapon produces, knowing that, especially if we're thinking about the Soviet Union or China, they could fight back, right? We're not going to take out their whole arsenal in one shot. But so that whole approach assumes that we all have the same goal, that we care about surviving more than winning. So there are people who would argue that we do, in fact, care about surviving more than winning. But there's also reason to think that maybe, even if not today, maybe someday there will be leaders who think differently.
Yeah.
And it raises that issue of, are we mature enough as a species to handle this knowledge that we found? And I think one of the things that is problematic with that is when you talk about a species, you're talking about billions of individuals. And it's the low end of the maturity spectrum that we have to worry about, right? It's not our most mature and saintly individuals who are going to determine this question of, are we mature enough as a species? It's the worst case scenarios, right? It's the extremist. It's those who are not behaving as rational actors that, if they have the power to use these weapons, are going to make that decision for the species as a whole. Right.
You just made a point that I tried to make earlier, but you made it so much more eloquently. So thank you.
That's what I'm here for, Dale.
In his interview with the New York Times about his film, Nolan says that Oppenheimer is the most important person who ever lived.
That comes out in the movie, too, at one point. Yeah.
And this interviewer pushes back, and that's a bit of hype. And he's, if my worst fears are true, he'll be the man who destroyed the world. What's more important than that, right? He says he's also the most important, but hopelessly naive. Right. Because he had so many ideas about like how we can end the war with this thing.
Well, that was
I agree.
Thing.
That does come out in the movie.
Emotionally. The movie comes out that he thinks that this will end the war.
End war altogether.
Yeah. End war.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. End war altogether, which does seem incredibly naive, given isn't that exactly what Alfred Nobel thought of dynamite?
Yes.
And.
Yeah, that's a good connection.
And dynamite can be an incredibly destructive force.
Just made bigger bombs.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
so
both times.
So for Oppenheimer to think that this development of destruction is somehow going to be the one that saves us, when we have a clear example with dynamite that did not happen, even though people thought this was somehow going to be preventative.
I have another Nolan quote. Let me give the backstory real quick, right? So Nolan grew up in the UK during the height of nuclear anxiety, right? And anti-nuke demonstrations. And he remembers a little kid hearing the Sting song Russians, right? Where there's that line, how can I save my little boy from Oppenheimer's deadly toy? And as a kid, that name stuck with him, right? And then he reads later, Robert Pattinson, the actor, gave him Oppenheimer's speeches on the set of Tenet as a rap gift. Hey, filming's done. Here you go. And he started reading that, and he says that you are not necessary. As he was reading, when you read the words of people speaking at the time, you see them wrestling with the implications and the consequences of what's happened and what they've done. And he found that just really fascinating. And then he says, you are not necessarily confronted with the strongest or worst elements of your action in the moment. And he thought that. And I think that comes out really clear for me. Do you remember the scene where they're in the auditorium after the bomb test is gone? And he's like, rah, America. I think maybe Japan surrendered. And then there's that really, it's awful, but it's that moment where the audio stops. And for a moment, you hear just a child screaming. And then there's this look on his face. Because so much of this movie is Cillian Murphy's face. His face and violins. The composer, Ludwig Göransson, said that he had to speak for Oppenheimer, who I guess in the film is not. I don't know how he was in real life, but in the film, he's very reserved and doesn't talk a lot. So there's always violins playing when you see on close-ups of his face. right? And they can be like joyful, but they can also be very melancholic and horrific. And that moment with the scream, just that really got me, because you also see his face contorting. Mm-hmm. It's just now dawned on him what could happen. And yeah, that hadn't been in his naivete, right? That hadn't been something.
Do any of you know when he said this quote? And there's an explosion afterwards, but here's the quote.
"Now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds."
That's the quote. That's a good mic drop.
Yeah. Well,
thank you. I edited those together. I'm glad that you enjoyed that, Clint. So, but that's actually from the Bhagavad Gita, right? So this is not Christian. This is a statement of, I have now the power of destruction.
Yeah.
That, and so at some level, he did understand what he had wrought on the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Was that after Trinity?
Yes. Which was another question I wanted to ask. Do any of you have any sense on why that first bomb was called Trinity?
I don't know.
I read something somewhere about a reference to Trinity and God.
Yeah.
I didn't understand. Was that because it has this kind of godlike power at our hands? I heard it was a reference to a John Donne poem, but both Google and ChatGPT just failed me on this one. I never got a very clear, definitive answer on this.
Why New Mexico is portrayed in the film accurately, as I understand, right? It's just, he used to go camping there when he was a kid with his brother, and he just liked it. He's like, let's do New Mexico.
Let's drop a bomb there.
And they wanted a remote location.
And it was remote.
In order to keep
everything to be remote.
It's interesting that the Soviets, when they started developing their nuclear program, located them in Novosibirsk, which is also very much in the middle of nowhere. I've actually attended a conference there.
Oh, wow.
Kirsten, I mentioned earlier that you and I were both United Methodists, and United Methodists often put out these statements. It's called the social principles, and they certainly have one about warfare. What does United Methodist Church say about warfare as an example of a theological body or religious body making a statement?
Essentially, that war is incompatible with the teachings of Christ, and that we should do everything in our power to obtain peace, to prevent wars from erupting. It encourages the social principles encourage the use of alliances, treaties, international law, all the sorts of things that governments use to try and overcome their differences and work toward more peaceful relations.
So it doesn't go so far as to say pacifism, but it says every step possible of diplomacy before engaging in warfare.
It does, but it also does say, I believe, that war is incompatible with the teachings of Christ. And so it does take – it doesn't say pacifism, I don't think, but it does take a pretty strong stand that war is not a good thing.
And in your expert opinion, summarize all your research of the past how many ever years, how has diplomacy worked? Where are we in the world right now in terms of warfare? And where are we, threat of nuclear war or just destroying ourselves at all?
Yeah.
I think we're doing great. We're doing great.
So I think we're at a low point. We're not at a great point because many reasons I could think about. One, most of the countries that have nuclear weapons, and there are not a lot of them, but some of us have lots of nuclear weapons, right? And I think almost every country that has nuclear weapons in their arsenal is trying to build more and better ones right now. Arms control is at an all-time low. And actually, the United Methodist Social Principles would say, engage in arms control, try to limit the arms that you have. Mm-hmm. And we've let a lot of agreements either expire or we've abrogated them, we've exited them. And it looks like the only big nuclear weapons agreement that is still in place is probably going to expire without being replaced.
And with these expirations, have we immediately changed our behavior? Or is it just that we have the possibility of changing our behavior now with those expiring?
I would say we have not immediately changed our behavior, but some of those have been broken because behavior had already begun to shift.
Okay.
And so I think you're not going to see an abrupt change when the last agreement falls, but yet you're going to see leading up to that more and more transgressions and slowly changing behavior, creating greater insecurity. And so everybody's afraid then to negotiate a new agreement to limit arms buildups because we don't trust each other.
And on that cheery note, what hasn't been said that needs to be said?
I guess my parting thought would be, if we look at Oppenheimer in particular and the Manhattan Project, if the atomic bomb had not been developed then, was it inevitable that it was going to be developed at some point later on? I mean, the knowledge in physics was progressing in a direction that was going to make it possible. And if it didn't happen then, I think you could make a case that it was going to happen at some point later on. And at some point, we've just got to live up to the knowledge that we're producing. We've got to make ourselves mature enough to be able to deal with the things that we know.
That's a very big ask.
It is. I agree.
Yeah.
I would agree with what Todd just said. I think we are very smart creatures. We are also security-seeking creatures. And so I think that knowledge was bound to be discovered at some point by someone. Oppenheimer was just the first to get there. I do want to say, too, I know I've sounded like super pessimistic through this whole discussion. And
actually, I would say you sounded very reasonable in your assessment. It came over as, I mean, I didn't think you were like a doomsdayer, but a very good assessment of
realistic.
Realistic.
And I was just going to close by saying that while I do have some concerns, and it doesn't help that like nationalism is growing everywhere too, but I also think there are really smart people trying to do good and trying to prevent bad things from happening.
We're going to stop right there while we have an optimistic moment.
Yay!
So that's right. Todd, I'm going to nail you down right now. I want you to come back on. I want to talk about this JWST. I want to talk about the things that we're learning with the space telescope.
That sounds great.
I'm just flabbergasted, and it just seems like we are.
I guess that'll be much more fun.
Yes, that will. Yeah.
A happier conversation.
That's right.
This was fun, but a happier conversation.
And I do. I thank all of you. Kirsten, for your first time, how did it feel?
Felt good.
Yeah?
Yeah, thank you.
No, I want more detail than that. That felt good.
That'll be in the post-show evaluation.
That's right. During the assessment stage. So, and Clint, I know during the leftover section, you're going to have more for us just about the movie techniques and all
this,
the...
This was fun.
Yeah.
I enjoyed
it. I had a good time as well.
So. Yeah.
Well, I want to thank our audience out there for sitting around the table with us. And I hope that we have provided you with some food for thought and something to chew on. But we aren't done yet. Like I said, after we finish... we'll always have some leftovers for you to enjoy, some additional thoughts we share with one another after we wrap up. So feel free to continue listening. You know, I appreciate your support, and then I always ask you to support us with subscribing, rating, reviewing. You really haven't been doing that, so don't do that. All right? I'm going to use reverse psychology.
Yeah.
Don't subscribe. Don't rate us. Don't review us. Don't do any of that. Just sit and watch Church Potluck, and that will be good enough. It's just think of yourself as coming to the church potluck without anything in your hand. That's all you have. That's all you have.
And we're all staring at you.
Yeah. That's right. So until we gather around the table next time, this has been Church Potluck. Thank you so much for listening.
Bye-bye.
All right. So we're done with recording. You can take off your headphones if you want, but we can keep on just chatting amongst ourselves.
Sweet. Ooh, can I talk about production?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
But before we thank you so much, and especially, it was good. That was my assessment of your job. No, actually, for being first time, I thought that was awesome. Not even being first time, I just thought that I really enjoyed your perspective. I knew Todd's stuff a little bit, but that was all new to me. So I really enjoyed that a lot.
Good,
so.
Thank you.
Yeah, that was great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what didn't we say? What didn't we say about the production, sir?
So I love this movie so much. I just want to tell you guys that. Like when I saw it in the theater, my friend Morgan was with me. He's a sous chef at Blossom Hill. When we left, I was like yelling in the car, cinema is back, baby. I mean, Nolan gets it. He gets a cinematic experience, right? And that is different from, say, home movies or, you know, watching it on your phone. And I watch movies on my phone. I'm not like a snob. Like there are some movies that I don't know how much of a difference it makes where you see it and how you see it, right?
This one does make a difference.
I think this one makes one. Yeah. I don't know if any other movie has made a bigger difference on me personally, right? Seeing it in the theater, feeling the noises, again, that sonic atmosphere. Right, hearing the violins.
Dunkirk.
Yeah, yeah, I've heard a lot of people say that about Dunkirk.
I can see that.
Yeah, and it's, you know, Nolan. It's he really gets it, right? And I know that's like a cheesy sort of like film bro-y thing.
It was so good it actually pulled me out of the movie once.
Oh, that's fascinating.
I wonder if they're going to get an Academy Award for sound because the scene you were talking about when they were in the theater and just the just way too loud cheering. I mean too loud in a
purposefully
too loud,
unsettling.
And then it goes silent and then you know it's coming back though, right? And then boom, you know, and it just so much use of just the extremes of sound and silence. Yeah. Just I thought were very effective.
The visuals were so great too. Like that scene, I love the fact that there's a basketball goal hung up in the background.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is it makes it feel so real. Like this is a space that this was their recreation space.
And it was multiple use. I noticed that too. Yeah. The basketball, but it was a fire, a little fireplace.
Yeah.
This is their multi-use space. This is a community center.
So they had to build a community to do all this work. And that really brought it to
life. And it's in that spot where this
outside
this
of Ghost Ranch.
Yeah.
I wanted to point out Nolan was an English major. Just throwing that out there. So that was pretty cool. City University.
Yay, liberal arts.
Liberal arts. In London, and I was listening to, if you ever get a chance, the Blank Check podcast is really excellent. So it's just a bunch of guys.
Right up there with Church Potluck.
Yes, that's right. No, it's like Church Potluck.
almost.
Blank Check, and then what's the Roman Mars podcast, right? There we are. There's the Trinity.
There you go.
so they're just a bunch of guys that talk about like authors who have this success, and then studios will be like, well, here's just a bunch of money. And Nolan is probably the Blank Checkiest director alive right now. Like, really, only Nolan probably could have made Oppenheimer, right? Because it's a three-hour movie that's rated R, that's just a very slow
drama. I forgot about the R-rated.
Drama, right? And it's an R. It's definitely his most R-rated film.
I never
film.
Even thought about that. A three-hour movie rated R.
I remember when the nudity started, and I was like, oh, Chris, wow, this is new for you, buddy. Like, he's never done nudity. I've seen all of his films. I don't recall any nudity. He just doesn't really go there, right? But he went there. In this film. And 3 hours, so you can't even play it that often. $100 million, like, I don't know anyone else that could have done that, right? And also, who else could have done that after he basically dunked on Warner Brothers for sending all their movies to HBO Max? Like, he was very publicly angry at them during the pandemic that they did that. And he had broke a very long-standing and very profitable, successful relationship with them. And normally people can't come back from that, right? If you bite the hand that feeds you, you get sunk, right? Josh Trank, who directed that awful Incredibles movie, but before that did Chronicle, he had a lot of trouble after he tweeted something that he then deleted about the producers. Dale, you want to say?
I was going to say that's power when you can bite the hand and it'll still.
I mean, he didn't just bite it; he like tore the hand off. He went after him. But luckily, he met up with somebody from Universal. And I love this. The person from Universal, let's see, I'm going to try to find their name. They had the same vision that Nolan did, which is to bring cinemas back. They were like, we want movies to go back to the cinema. We feel that that's like a place that is different from the home or from the car or from wherever people are watching films, where it's like, it's almost kind of like going to church. Like, you know, there's like, you can see it. You're going there and, you know.
It's a transcendent experience.
Yeah, transcendent experience. Thank you. You know, Roland Barthes describes it as a dream state, right? Like, you're going there.
It's a communal experience.
It's a communal experience. Yeah. Exactly.
Well, it is. I didn't talk with the one other guy in the
You have your popcorn instead of your wafers, right?
Yeah.
You're drinking your Coke instead of your wine.
It is really communal this time with Barbenheimer, right?
Yeah. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. That made me so happy. I was so happy about all of that.
That was a fun phenomenon I wanted to take part of, but I didn't. I think that is so cool.
So much fun.
Had my children been within closer, I would have tried to do that.
I saw Barbie. Go for it.
We need to have another podcast too on Barbie and Chinese geopolitics. Because the whole, you know, Vietnam's not showing the movie because the 9-dash line is depicted in the map behind Barbie in one of the promo shots.
Oh, I didn't even know about that.
Yep.
Oh, my God. I saw Barbie with my other guy friend who's also in his, like, late 30s. And we were just in a theater filled with 14 to 15-year-old girls. And they all kind of gave us looks. We're like, hey, we want to watch this too. Yeah. Like, why do you? Yeah,
you know. Don't own this.
Exactly.
That's right.
And they also really seemed to love Barbie. Like I like that they
Barbie's
were laughing.
Coming back, apparently.
Yeah, they were liking the right scenes. Can I get some more notes? It's
okay.
No, it's probably fine. So the backstory, you know, he grew up during the nuclear anxiety, Nolan, that is, the anti-nuke demonstrations, you know, the Oppenheimer word from the Sting song stayed in his brain. And then if you guys saw Tenet, which I will say is my least favorite of his films.
It seems to be the case.
Yeah.
People think it's just too convoluted to follow.
I think it's kind of a mess, right? And, you know, one of the things I love about Nolan is that he is very temporally experimentive, and I think that's awesome.
Memento is
fabulous.
Yeah,
and Dunkirk, oh my God, right? You got the, like, what is it, 3 days 1 day, 1 hour or something structure, like, and just that he weaves back and forth, and that as a viewer, I never feel lost, and that they all sync up at one point. Mm-hmm. Like, it's really genius and takes a lot of foresight.
My son was very excited to show me Memento, which was,
Memento is very fun. If you ever see Following, his first film, it really feels like a dry run for Memento. Like, it's like a cool idea. There's some temporal exploration, but Memento feels like he like perfected it. It's like the last draft of that idea. Yeah.
So you've mentioned Tenet twice, mm-hmm. and in my mind, Tenet was very recent.
2020.
So he had the idea for this in 2020, and it's in the theaters in 2023. I know.
So no, it's amazing. So Nolan is a one film at a time guy. That's it.
He's also to each movie.
Chris Nolan does not have email.
Hmm.
He does not have a smartphone. So he takes all of those distractions, which a part of me like really wishes I could do that.
Yeah.
And he knew. Again, Robert Pattinson gave him the collected speeches of Oppenheimer, and it was basically from that moment. So basically the wrap of Tenet was when this movie started.
So he had to get permission to do Oppenheimer before Tenet came out.
Well,
because
he might have. I don't know.
I'm 100% teasing, but the point that Tenet was not going to be well received.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He definitely did get. I haven't read the book. Have you guys read the Oppenheimer American Prometheus book?
I haven't.
Won the Pulitzer Prize. I hear it's amazing. No, he did read that.
Let me interrupt there too.
Yeah.
Because I meant to mention that in the first part of the podcast.
Mm-hmm.
That I think that is the perfect title.
Yeah.
And I understand why it wasn't called that for the movie.
Yeah.
It's such a title. But just the image of Prometheus stealing the fire and then what has been wrought on humanity because of that. Yep. And
also not understanding the consequences.
And not understanding the consequences and his punishment, you know, the anguish that Oppenheimer felt.
I
thought that was a wonderful analogy.
It is. It's such a good image, right?
Yeah.
So the rights were already optioned. That book was optioned like almost immediately, right? Because it was a big hit, won the Pulitzer. Sam Mendes, who directed like American Beauty and Jarhead, he had optioned it way back when it came out, 2005. But it just sat in development hell until Nolan was like, I want to make an Oppenheimer movie. Oh, sorry, Oppenheimer. And then so he has this book and he loves the book. And he's actually staring at this book. And I think in the front cover, there's a picture of Oppenheimer, right? It's like his face. And he just sees Cillian Murphy. He's like, well, that's I got my guy. Wow. So almost immediately, he knew Cillian Murphy was going to be this guy. And he flew to Ireland to ask him. One fun story I love is that he made Robert Downey Jr. fly to him in Mexico to like sort of audition in front of him. And then he offered him the part. And Downey was like, yeah. And then later in an interview, Downey was like, yeah, it was really weird. Because usually for me, I need like 38 phone calls before I'll agree to something. But it was Christopher Nolan. Oh, my God. A better story. It involves marriage counseling. Matt Damon, and he's very public about this. This isn't like a secret.
I've heard this story.
Have you heard this story?
I have too. Yeah.
He was having marriage trouble, and him and his wife were in counseling. And so to like work through things, because he was working a lot, he promised he would not work for, I don't remember, a year, 2 years or something. Because, you know, his wife wanted to have him at home, right? Yeah. But he's like, okay, unless it's Christopher Nolan.
And then the phone rang.
And then the phone rang. And he's like, well, he was in the pact. I think it was in writing. Yeah. And he was like, yeah, well.
You know, football coaches. Football coaches do that too. That I am your coach and you have to buy me out unless – often it's Notre Dame unless Notre Dame or my alma mater calls, and then I'm out of here. And so it's the same thing. So unless Nolan calls, I'm yours. But
so he got those guys pretty early on, and then he really wanted all the faces to be very distinct, which is why we have such an amazing cast, right? Like, oh my God, like how many big players are here?
Yeah.
And he wanted people that were very distinct, right? So, you know, like Rami Malek is only in it for like 3 minutes, but he's like a very distinct looking person, right? I think Casey Affleck too, like his role as like this menacing figure, I think was like really on point and very memorable.
But it's another time when I was pulled out of, that's another time when I was pulled out of the movie thinking, wow, these are big names with kind of cameos almost. And so this is, and then, it just shows you how big of a movie it was,
and they just kept coming
to be part of it.
So Nolan is one of those directors, kind of like Clint Eastwood. He allows his actors to have leeway in terms of how they approach their characters. Cillian Murphy said, I think the quote I have here is, quote, I don't have the intellectual capacity for the quantum physics, so I focused on the humanity, right? So he didn't learn anything about quantum physics. He's just like, I'm just going to go with the character, right? Benny Sadfi, who is a director in his own right, he co-directed Uncut Gems with his brother, if you ever saw that. He plays Edward Teller. He actually had studied nuclear physics in undergrad, and he went back to his notes and he talked to one of his old professors to prepare for this role, right? So learning more about the math and the science behind it as a way of understanding his character, right? Mm-hmm. So two completely different approaches, but Nolan does a great job of sort of allowing them to do that, right? In reading about how Nolan directs, I saw a lot of writers compare him to Oppenheimer in the sense that, like, you know, Todd, you were saying earlier, like, what made him so special, right? And they were saying things like he was able to wrangle all of these personalities, mm-hmm. right? And all of their different ideas and sort of like congeal them, right? And sort of re-summarize things that everyone was saying in a cogent way mm-hmm. for everybody, that he was just like extremely good at that, right? And doing mm-hmm. it quickly, right? This film came together extremely fast. Everyone was really impressed. They were filming by, let's see here, I think February of 2022, they were already filming.
Well, even then, they're filming in January 2022, and it's out in theaters now. That is still
a year later.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know anything about movie making, but that just seems like from idea to screen, that just seems amazing.
Yeah, and like Kirsten mentioned, they had to build a town. Yeah. Like they built – because, you know, well, Nolan's all about the practical effects. They rebuilt this town. They couldn't use Los Alamos now.
There's a big national lab there now.
Which I thought that was interesting, that it was so barren, but now it is –
yeah, there's a town that he's built up around the National Labs, right?
Yeah. Some more fun facts. Filming locations included Einstein's actual office as well as Oppenheimer's actual childhood home. They actually shot scenes there. It was the first film to use IMAX in black and white, which is interesting. Yeah. And also another like playful thing he does where Robert Downey Jr.'s sort of side is always in the black and white.
Yeah. Yes.
Right?
I thought that was effective for,
right?
for time. Yeah, I thought
and it was very good. Yes, it was very good to avoid confusion. Yeah. Right? I think that was really helpful, but also like thematically.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's kind of interesting that the black and white part is actually the most recent part.
Yes.
Oh, right. Yeah, in terms of the filming. Yeah. Oh, chronologically. Yes.
Yeah,
that makes sense. Let's see here.
It happens latest in time.
Some of the reasons the filming went a bit quicker is Nolan lets his actors sort of play around. He doesn't put marks on the floor. He doesn't do that. Also, everything was very stripped down comparatively. There's a quote I have somewhere. Robert Downey Jr. was on set and he was looking around for like his chair and he realized there wasn't one. Like it wasn't a set where people had their own chairs with their names on it. Like they're just what? Can I use a swear word? Is that okay?
Yes. You.
Nolan doesn't have time for that bullshit. we need to make this and go and then let's move on. Which is another sort of Clint Eastwood thing. Famously, Clint Eastwood will just say we're going to rehearse and then he'll just film
seeing,
it.
I am seeing a theme though. Robert Downey Jr., you come to me for the audition.
Yeah, I know.
No you chair for
yourself.
You.
Yourself. But the guy might get an Oscar out of it. So I think it
Iron
went.
Man,
I think
Iron Man.
Yeah, I think it went totally fine. As inspiration, he noted Tarkovsky, the famous Russian director, his movie Mirror, which is also very nonlinear and is also a meditation on war. Sorry, here's a Robert Downey Jr. quote. There was no chair with your name on it. It was focused and Spartan, almost a monastic approach, right? That's a Robert Downey Jr. quote. Other notes, dude, it grossed $891 million,
wow.
Which a movie that's 3 hours long about a scientist.
That is shocking.
Freaking awesome.
Clint,
yeah.
You know what I'm learning?
Yeah. What are you going to do?
From all of this?
Yeah.
That you need your own podcast.
No, thank you for letting me nerd out about this film. I sincerely love this film, so thank you for doing this.
I need to see it.
If only you,
I need to see it again.
If only you had let that show in your voice, you know.
Right.
Thank you all so much. That
thank
was
you.
That
thank
was,
you.
That was
dope.
Yeah.
It was a lot of fun for sure.